time to be a Celtics fan. Hello, Calvin.
Hello, Murray.
This is Careless Whispers, everybody. Normal time, normal day. And we're back, and the Celtics are not. The second round of the NBA playoffs has started, and the Celtics have cleaned out their lockers. It is summer vacation, as RJ Hunter put it. And Calvin's here to pull my teeth out and talk to me about it for a little while to start this show. Right, buddy?
Yeah, man. We were not on last week. Oh, really? No, we weren't. And apparently Rory's got a new living situation, so we may not be on next week. So we wanted to get in some hot Celtics talk now while we still can. Should we just go right to the call lines? Apparently we already have a call waiting.
We do already have a call waiting, and to begin the show, I was starting to wonder whether anybody even realized that we switched over a month ago to our own platform here at CLNS Radio. We're not matched up with the post-game show call number anymore, so we have our own call number. It's 323-642-1484. It is still free, so that's nice. And if I knew who was the sponsor for the post-game show last minute, I'd tell you, but I just don't have that together right now. So, too bad. Thank you for whoever that was. You're the best. But yeah, Calvin, let's go to it, and maybe this guy will spark some interest in me here. He's our number one caller. He's probably called more than anybody else combined on this show. Mad Dog, buddy, what's going on? You all right?
I'm fine. I'm down on the Cape. Life is good.
You're down on the Cape, isn't it? Like 45 degrees there?
Yeah. We got a couple good days. I've gone out biking. I actually went to the Province Land the other day, and I got stuck at a bus stop in Provincetown. So yeah. It's been a good couple weeks. And
Calvin, it's been cold and rainy here, and this guy's at the beach. What do you think of that?
I mean, it was 86 here today, so I can, you know, relate to somebody being on a beach. But, yeah, I think if you don't go in the water, it's kind of cool on a cold day to just sort of walk the beach. But what I want to know is, do you live on the Cape now? I feel like you only call us from the Cape. Are you ever even in Maine anymore?
I was for a few months, and I'm back down here working in the summer. So I'm down here. I just got down here a couple of weeks ago. We had a nice week last week. And by the way, Rory, I wanted to tell you they have boats from Boston to Provincetown. So that's your fastest way of getting to the Cape, right there.
Got it. I'd rather drive, but thank you.
Okay. I just saw that the other day. A day when I was up there, they have Race Point and they have the Province Lands, which are the big sand dunes. It's a great workout. I bike all over the Cape, so to answer your question, Calvin. For most of the year and probably permanently.
Loving the Cape. Loving the Cape. All right, Mad Dog. Well, more importantly, what's going on with your thoughts on the Celtics here
as they end this season,
this playoff run in a terrible fashion? They just had poor effort in that game six.
Well, here's my thoughts on the Celtics. Is that it's not unexpected here. I would have loved to have seen them win a round, but I think that the reality needs to set in for some people and some people that I've heard on the radio around Boston and some people I've heard around. Well, the reality needs to set in here that this is that we are a million miles away from a championship team here. This team is built on a bunch of role players that will are good enough to get a few key wins during the regular season, obviously at Golden State, at Cleveland. But when it comes to the postseason, this team is not going to do anything. I think that we need to come to the realization of this now and need to come to avenues to correct the problem. This right here is not going to work long term with this roster. No matter how long you keep them together, you may be able to get a round out of them. At some point, you're never going to be able to make it to the finals with a roster like this. And I think it's time for I think it's time for some work for Danny Ainge here to get done.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. This is something I was going to sort of hit Murray with. And I think every year we watch the regular season, and because the regular season's so long, like we sort of fall in love with these teams or how they play, or we think like these are what teams are, and we sort of forget that playoff basketball is an entirely different beast than regular season basketball. And I tend to go along with the theory that Brad Stevens is such a good coach that he sort of coached this team up during the regular season. You could see them playing harder than everyone else. Well, in the playoffs, everybody plays hard. You know, you can give them somewhat of a benefit of the doubt because, yes, they didn't have Avery Bradley. But on the other hand, like, Avery Bradley's Avery Bradley. Like, I watched the final two games of this series, and Rory, you can tell me if you disagree with me. And the Celtics got obliterated in those two games. I know they won the final game by 12, but that game was over, you know, middle of the third quarter.
The Hawks, I left that thing early. I left a minute early, but my buddy left with like 8 or 9 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. He gave up real quick.
Yeah, and you know, congrats to them for showing their fighting spirit. But like they never actually had a chance to come back in that game. The lead was just, it was too big. So, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
and you know what? I muted him because the echo's going. There's an echo here, if you couldn't tell. But you know what, Mad Dog? I'm not trying to portray the fact that I think that I have lofty expectations. Both Calvin and I picked the Hawks to win this series in 7 games. I just really wanted to see a little bit better effort towards the end of the series, and I understand not having Avery Bradley hurts, and having Kelly Olynyk out there with one arm is not really that effective at all. So they were depleted, but it just seemed like for the first time all season, they actually just gave up at times in both of those games. And that's just not the way that I wanted them to go out. I didn't expect them to win a round, but Atlanta was clearly the better team. And I think, like you said, Mad Dog, we all knew that coming into this series, and some people just sort of had their aspirations a little too high for this team.
Well, yeah, and I'll leave you guys with this. I just think like you have some people in this town. Like I listen to some of the local sports shows in this town. Somebody in the middle of the year picked the Celtics over Golden State in 6. You've had Mike Gorman come out with his trade. His no trade list, which included like 9 guys on the roster. And Mike Gorman is famous.
Well, Calvin, don't get the wrong idea here. Hold on. I got to cut you off here for a second, man.
Okay.
Calvin, don't get the wrong idea. This was a situation where the radio guys in the morning asked Mike Gorman who he would want to keep on this from the roster, because they were talking about trade speculation. It was a trade deadline type of segment on their show, and Mike Gorman phrased it in a way that he made it very clear that if he were making decisions, and he's talking about players on a personal level, he included Tyler Zeller on his list. He went all the way down the list. He gave positive attributes about pretty much every player on the roster, including Zeller, saying that he personally likes Tyler Zeller. And they took that soundbite and spun it into Mike Gorman would not trade any of the players on the Celtics.
So he never actually said that. It was them spinning it into something bigger than everyone.
Well, he did say, "Guy, if it were up to me, I would keep Tyler Zeller. He's a guy I really like." That type of thing. But it was all in context, and it's all talking about their roles, and he just liked the makeup of the team. That was more his overall point. But they took the end of his interview, that one little comment about Zeller, and spun it out of proportion, which is why they're on the radio here. They do it very well.
Well, Rory, what I'd like to know is how do you feel about the makeup of the team? Do you think that the only difference? I know we both picked the Hawks in seven, but in retrospect, after watching the series, do you feel like Avery Bradley was the difference in the series? Do you think the Celtics would have won it had Bradley been in it?
Hold on, let Mad Dog finish his point here, and then I'll answer that for you. All right, Mad Dog, go ahead, buddy.
Okay. Really, I didn't hear. I'll admit that I didn't hear that in real time. I was actually listening to the Felger and Mad show, and they did a cut
exactly
of that. And I know that Michael Felger, I know that those two guys want to sort of the whole Green Teamers stuff. But overall, this team needs to make moves. They need to make moves, and they need to make them. They need to make them quickly here, and it all starts with the draft. What pick are they going to have? Are they going to have the first pick, second pick? What pick are they going to have here? And that's going to play a big part. And then the Kevin Durant stuff this summer, and there's many other free agents. If they don't get Kevin Durant, they shouldn't just sit on their hands and knees here. There's other free agents out there. I know that they're going to be striving big for him. But guys, great show, and it's great to have you back on the air again, and let's go Celtics.
All right, buddy. Thanks a lot. There he goes, Mad Dog, one of our most loyal listeners, if not the most loyal, besides Liz, of course. Just been there since day one. He's been there since day one. Like, how many episodes have we done now? 200 or something? He's been there since day one. He doesn't really miss an episode. Sam is a throwback guy out there in San Diego, but you never know when he's tuning in, you know? So Mad Dog, tried and true right there. All right, Calvin, I've actually thought about this in the past couple of days, and so I'm ready to go with an entire breakdown if you really want to get into it.
Yeah, let me elaborate a little, I guess, to be fair, because it wasn't just Avery Bradley who missed the series. It was Kelly Olynyk who, you know, wasn't 100% in the series. Jay Crowder, you can argue, had not, you know, physically returned to form. You can make that argument. Do you think that injuries, I guess, would you describe that as the primary reason this team didn't win the series? Or do you think that it was more of a lack of talent / shooting / anything else?
It's a primary reason they didn't compete throughout the series, and they only did really play well in those two games at home. And I mean, the Celtics never really blew out the Cavs or the Hawks. Excuse me, I'm thinking of who the Hawks are playing right now. The Celtics never really blew out the Hawks in that series. They had those two great games at home, and they ended up pretty much controlling both of those games. And people would probably argue that throughout the game, there was very little doubt that the Celtics were going to either have a chance to win or be ahead at the end of those two games. But the Hawks dominated the Celtics a couple of times in that series. And that, to me, is the difference. The talent level was bigger than we thought, and it's even worse when those injuries occur. So the discrepancy was when you're just looking at those first four games of the series and it's split down the middle. Somebody from the outside would say, "Oh, look, it's 2-2. It's a whole new series." Well, not really, because the Hawks kind of dominated in the first two games. I mean, the first game was only 1 point, but we all know that they got out to a huge lead, and the Celtics had to claw back and get back into that one in order to even have a chance of winning that game, and they didn't. But then, on the other hand, the two games in Boston, they played two of their best games all season, really, back-to-back, and they still were the Hawks were keeping up with them for the most part in throughout those games. So to me, that, I mean, even though the series was even after the first four games, the Hawks had the edge, and it was just a matter of whether the Celtics could sustain enough of a push and enough energy to play with them for another three games. Turns out, no, they could not.
Big picture, then, how would you describe this season? We talked about them, you know, before the season started. Do you feel like the season is ultimately a success? Are you happy with, you know, this particular team and where it ended up, or do you leave the season with a sense of dissatisfaction?
Yeah, it's too bad that it ended with the last two games like that, and the injuries, and just not having very good performance there to lose the series. But overall, I'm sticking to it. I think it was a successful season. Isaiah Thomas was on the team for the whole year. They got a chance to work him in for an entire season, and they got to get close to 50 wins, so that was good for them. I think they overachieved a little bit in that regard. And even though they kind of fell flat on their face towards the end of the season, I think overall they took a step in the right direction. They got a couple of playoff wins, and they know what it's like now to be able to compete in the playoffs. So I'm hoping that some of these guys stick around and that the coach learns a lot this year from what he just went through, because that's the biggest thing on this for this organization right now, because they don't have that superstar. Can the coach continue to take mid-level to above average players, or I guess I should say mid to high level above average players? You know what I'm saying? Like, if you wanted to tier them into like 10 groups or something, anyway, and get the most out of them, and get them to play past their potential, because that's what he's been doing with a lot of guys this year.
So you said that they don't have the superstar. So where are you at with Isaiah Thomas at this point? I watched the last two games. Look, there were games in that series that Isaiah was a beast, and I gave him credit at times for playing, you know, better defensively, but they went at him hard in those final two games, and they really destroyed him on that end. Do you believe Isaiah Thomas, if not a superstar, is a player that you can count on consistently going forward, or do you think, you know, maybe he'll come through in a big moment and maybe he won't?
Listen, I think you can count on this kid, but you need to put somebody else around him. Well, I mean, once he developed that relationship with Avery Bradley, and he sort of gained the confidence that Bradley was going to be there to bail him out, whether it be on a backdoor cut or just hanging out in the corner on one of Thomas's drives, he became more comfortable in his own game, you know? So when that was gone, I feel like that hurt Thomas more than it hurt anybody else. And he was the sole scorer. He was the only guy that could really score off the dribble. And he was the only guy that they really didn't need to run specific plays for to score. So the defense just started to hone in on him. And then they did have to run specific plays for him. It just didn't work out. So I think Thomas was hurt more by Bradley than anybody else going down. And it's just a matter of, are you out in the wind right now? It's very distracting. It's just a matter of whether or not he can gain that confidence back, or they can find another type of shooter like that, because there was nobody else that he could rely on. You know what I mean?
Is that better at all? It's just really hot in here.
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. So I do agree with you about confidence. I do think that decision-making factors into it as well. I think I think the offense that they put around him matters. I think that Isaiah sort of has to play a point. You know, everyone's talking about how this team needs more shooting, and I agree they need more shooting. But I also think that they need more ball handling. They need more dribbling. You know what I mean? They need more like secondary assists are great, but like dribble penetration assists is something that this team like lacks for. I think Marcus Smart has to develop in that area. How'd you feel about his season?
I mean, the main focus that people are taking away from Marcus Smart, the soundbite, if you will, the small clip about what his season was is that he has become notorious for flopping. So I think that he took some strides in other areas. I think that he's become a better on the ball defender. I think that despite his confidence increasing in his 3-point shot, he hasn't actually taken that large of a step in actually being able to make them. But I think his ball handling has been better and his confidence in being an actual point guard has been great. But it's all tainted, Calvin, by the flopping. And if refs are going to start watching him for that, and if guys around the league are going to start knowing that he's going to be looked at as a flopper, they're going to be able to get away with more against him. And he may think that it helps the team. He may think that he's doing everything he can and that he's getting away with it enough to help. But I think more often than not, he's taking himself out of plays and he's actually hurting the team by doing stuff like that. So that's what I think of Marcus Smart's season. He needs to clean that up.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was even a problem. I usually don't think of him as like, you know what? Because he does flop, but he's like a Derek Fisher type flopper, which is like, he's not a soft flopper. He like somehow makes it look physical. So I've never
it's
particularly
terrible.
Had an issue with
that. I mean, he got fined in the playoffs for it. So not a lot of guys are getting fined at this point in the season for flopping. You know what I'm saying? So it's got to be pretty blatant. Put it, and it was.
All right, so let's turn our attention to, you know, most of these guys are on the roster for next season, and we'll get into this more as we go into the off season or what the Celtics should do, you know. Should they go after Kevin Durant? I mean, obviously, but, you know, who are the targets? What can this team do to get better? Whatever. But just, I want a sort of instant reaction from you about the two big guys on the roster who could be gone, could be here again. Jared Sullinger, he had a terrible series against the Hawks. Yep. I think a lot of that was matchup, but it seems like Celtics fans are just ready to let him walk.
Bye-o.
Are you right there?
Bye-o. See you later. Get out of here, Jared Sullinger. Have another cheeseburger. Go away somewhere else. Go back to Cleveland. Go to Cleveland. Maybe they'll like him in Ohio again. See ya.
Really?
Drink your juice. Take a nap. Goodbye.
Murray, how long ago was Celtics fans, you know, saying that, like, Jared Sullinger is untradeable? You remember that? That was
Untradeable. Please. Never untradeable. Never untradeable. Always had high potential. Always was a question with injury in my mind. And if he could surpass the injury problems, then he would be fine. He got over the back issues, it seemed, and he can't keep the conditioning down, and he just became an anchor in the playoffs, Calvin. The team, they stopped moving when he was out there. Things just did not look like the team that we saw for the past couple of weeks, even when Bradley was in there for that brief period. With Sullinger on the floor, just things did not look good, especially towards the end of the season. I've had enough of him. I'm one of those guys. Get him out of here at this point. Let him walk away.
Let him walk away, huh? Let this young guy just walk away.
He's set up to make $4.4 million. I mean, I guess maybe you pick that up. That's the qualifying offer. So, I don't know. Maybe you give him the qualifying offer and see what else happens, right? See what happens next year. But do not extend
right.
This guy. You know what I'm saying? Please do not extend Jared Sullinger. That's the last thing you want to do.
Well, since you'll be saving that money that you may have earmarked for Jared Sullinger, would you like to spend it on Evan Turner? Doing a few post-game shows, Celtics fans seem to think that Evan Turner is going to command like $10 to $12 million a year, which
yeah.
I have a hard time believing that. But let's just live in that hypothetical world for a second.
Well, I would like to live in that hypothetical world because if you consider that Al Horford's going to get a max deal, which is like, what's that, going to be $25 million a year, then
is he though?
10 to 12 for Evan Turner sounds reasonable
yeah.
for the market. But I would have a hard time just swallowing that number. So going in without knowing what the actual market is going to be for the entire league, I would say Evan Turner for the Celtics should be a mid-level exception type of guy. Give him whatever it is, $6 million, $7 million, whatever it's going to be next year, and give him that for a couple years or even just a year if he only wants to take it for that long. But I'm not going to 10 or 12 right now. I mean, you've already got Jay Crowder under contract for $6 million. Are you really going to give Evan Turner 10 or 12 when you're saying that Jay Crowder, according to Danny Ainge, was untouchable in a trade for Jimmy Butler? Like, come on, let's be real here. If you're going to give Jake Crowder a five-year deal that doesn't surpass $8 million, are you really going to pay Evan Turner more than $3 or $4 million more than that? Maybe they like him that much, but I just don't see it.
Okay, yeah. I think that the Celtics end will get a little out of hand with Evan Turner. But, again, I think that this team lacks ball. And the problem with Evan Turner is the fact that he just can't shoot from beyond a certain range, right? I mean, that's the problem with a lot of dudes on this team. It's going to be difficult just to find shooting in general in the NBA right now because everyone wants to become the Warriors. But particularly with the offense that the Celtics are running, I'm not sure. I guess where I'm at with him is, like, I'm not sure the personnel runs the personnel, like, completely matches the strategy. I mean, certain guys do and certain guys don't. You know, Jared Sollinger is not one of them. Amir Johnson, who I like a lot, is not someone that necessarily fits in ideally with this offense, but he can. I don't know that guys like Kelly Olynyk can hold up defensively or physically over the course of the NBA season, even though he sort of does fit that role a lot better.
Well, Sellinger's the only real question mark. I mean, the other guys are under contract, right? So Zeller's got a qualifying offer, it looks like. Here's an interesting thing. Both Amir Johnson and Jonas Jerebko have non-guaranteed salaries next year, which means that they can be cut by July 3rd if the Celtics don't want to keep their salary. It's not necessarily a team option, but if they don't cut those guys by July 3rd, which is, 10 days after the NBA draft, then those guys are on the team as well. So, to me, Calvin,
right,
I mean,
before free agency, too.
Right. It all happens at the NBA draft. If the Celtics make some sort of a maneuver at the NBA draft, you might be looking at Amir Johnson finding a new place to play next year, depending on who they bring in. But you never know what's going to happen with those guys. I'm interested to see which way they're going, because obviously they're basing this thing around Bradley, Thomas, Crowder, Marcus Smart, and then who knows? Maybe they bring back Turner. Maybe they bring back, or I guess Olynyk will be here, and then the young kids, Rozier, James Young, etc. Those guys for low contracts, but you got to figure they're going to bring in some mid-level guys. If Evan Turner's that mid-level guy, I'm okay with that.
So, Lurie, if they run that type of roster back, basically all the guys they have now, and maybe they add one more mid-level piece. Maybe they add, I don't know who's out there, so I'm gonna throw in a type of guy. What if they get like a Trevor Ariza type, or like, are you gonna feel satisfied with that going into next season? I guess is my question to you, or are you gonna feel like this team is sort of running in place?
It's tough, Calvin, because I think that they're still gonna be exciting, and I think that they can still take another small step forward if that's the case. And while it will be disappointing to not get a bigger name than Isaiah Thomas, or even a name as big as Isaiah Thomas in the offseason, then it would still be fun, I think. And I was thinking about this the other day. Honestly, there are players out there that you can go after. Nicholas Batum's a free agent. Bradley Beal's restricted. Guys like Harrison Barnes are restricted. Ryan Anderson is available if you like a guy like that. I like a kid like Terrence Jones, take a chance on him maybe. He's a restricted free agent with the Rockets. there are a lot of names out there that I think would improve the roster, and but not necessarily make the Celtics a contender in the East yet. But they could still maybe be a little bit better, maybe get that home court series and give themselves a better chance to win a first round series. And honestly, at this point, and I've said this all along, I'd rather the team be good and be competitive for long periods of time than take the Philadelphia route where you're terrible for a while and then potentially you have an Allen Iverson that comes along and you're good for a couple of years, and then potentially in 4 or 5 years Philadelphia will be good again. Who knows? But I'd rather have the Celtics plan where they are going along at a steady clip and slowly improving step by step while also being competitive and an exciting team to watch. And maybe that's just the fan in me and being greedy and wanting to take in good games when I go to the Garden. But that's just how it is, I guess.
Yeah, I definitely am with you there. And I definitely also don't believe in the philosophy that, like, it's better to be terrible or great and bad to be in the middle, because it's not possible to go from terrible right to great, you know, and barring some, like, a couple of fluky instances in NBA history. But for the most part, you go from terrible to okay, and then you, like, discover whether or not, you know, your players are legit. And then you either become terrible again or you get better. Like, the Warriors were the 8th seed, you know, 8 to 10 in the West for, like, 5 years before they became what they are. And I think that's what teams do. Now, obviously, the Celtics are missing that piece that's going to take them there. But they've opened up a myriad of avenues by which they can get there. We'll talk more about specific free agents and that kind of stuff for them as you know, the offseason continues. We have plenty of time here. I just wanted to sort of do a post-mortem on the season.
Yeah, well, how's that for a post-mortem? I just listed off a few names of players that I want them to target, and I don't know.
Are you ready to move on? You're just like, forget
I'm ready to
season.
Move on. I'm ready to go. Let's get the offseason going. When can we start talking to Kevin Durant? When can Danny Ainge call him?
Probably the next time we talk, depending on your schedule, we'll be right around the NBA draft lottery. So we'll have an idea of what position the Celtics are drafting in at that point, and then we can move on from there.
That's true. And I have a nice website that shows all the free agents for 2016 and sorts them by what their cap hit was last year, this current year. So if you ever want to see that, let me know.
Definitely. Yeah, you can show it to me.
All right. Moving on?
Yeah, we can move on.
Kobe Bryant was the number one free agent from this past year in salary, $25 million, just to let you know.
I'm surprised you didn't want to talk about
your Lakers at all on this show tonight, but...
Oh, you know what? I totally forgot. I did want to talk about my Lakers, but I completely forgot.
Well, why don't you then?
Yeah, thanks for reminding me. Sorry, the Lakers hired Luke Walton. I don't know if you heard. Golden State Warriors.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. Their own Luke Walton. Fanboy Luke Walton.
Yeah, their own Luke Walton. Yeah. I'm curious what you think of this move. I'll tell you what I think in a second, but I'm curious where you're at with it.
Well, is Luke Walton ready to be his own man, or was he really just a puppet for Golden State, or for Steve Kerr in Golden State? That's what I'm wondering, because I feel like even Walton will tell you that the other assistants and Steve Kerr were pretty much in his ear at all times. And I don't know if he really had full control over those games. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But is he ready to take a horrible roster and try and do something with it? I don't know. I mean, I guess he feels like he is, or he wouldn't have taken the job, right?
Yeah, I don't love the move, and it has nothing to do with Luke Walton. Well, it has some things to do with Luke Walton. But yeah, sorry about that. Hold on. So you're on point with it somewhat, which is I haven't. First of all, I have no idea whether or not Luke Walton is a good coach. He, I don't know what exactly. He was there. Do I think that Steve Kerr was like calling him during timeouts and telling him what plays to run? No, I'm sure Luke Walton himself had a hand in, you know, the Warriors getting off to a 24-0 start. But that does, again, first of all, I don't believe, unlike a lot of people, that coaching comes down like specifically to just results. You know what I mean? To me, a good coach is like getting your talent to overperform. Steve Kerr was the one who ran training camp. He was the one who set up that offense. Luke Walton sort of just grabbed the train and, you know, it was already on the tracks and he just conducted it. Good for him. But I have no idea whether or not that limited stretch of what it means to be a coach will make him a good coach. But to his credit, by all accounts, like the Warriors organization, everyone in the Warriors organization says that he's, you know, great to get along with, great working with young players. And that's something that, you know, coming off this Byron Scott situation, I think the Lakers need. But the reason why I'm ambivalent leaning towards dislike on this issue, it's because the Lakers already have a nepotism problem right now with their organization, and like the Byron Scott hire itself was it was part of a move to, like, you know, we hired Mike D'Antoni, now let's hire a Laker, you know, let's not find the best candidate.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think we kind of got into that me and my friends over sort of emails, and I was sort of telling them. I think that Byron Scott was just, what kind of a Laker can we get to coach the team? Well, Fisher's, he's not available right now. Let's see. So-and-so's not ready yet. Brian Shaw, we already tried that type of thing. Like, who's left?
Right, and there's a little bit of, I'm concerned right now. I'm worried about the fact that Jim Buss is going to leave only to be replaced by Phil Jackson. You know what I mean? Like, I'm concerned about that. And Luke Walton played for Phil Jackson, tried to hire him on with the Knicks, and Luke Walton ended up signing with the Lakers. So Luke Walton now with the Lakers, like, if we get rid of Jim Buss after next season, which, you know, it's quite possible, I don't want the door to then be open for Phil Jackson to come back. And that's sort of what this feels like. And moreover, it just feels like, look, there were guys who were more qualified. You know, say what you want about Blatt, but Torre Messina, the Spurs assistant head coach, is supposed to be a genius of, you know, the play calling and sort of NBA offense. So, and he coached, like, for years internationally. Yes, Luke Walton is young. You know, maybe he'll be appealing to free agents. Maybe the Lakers get a great free agent out of it. So that could be a positive. But I just have no idea if he's a good coach. And two, it just feels like they're doing the exact same thing they did with Byron and sort of doing this reactionary, like, yeah, let's get this young, fun Laker as head coach. Even though, like, the Lakers aren't going to run the Warriors' offense anyway. So,
What's the other solution, though? So, here's what the devil's advocate would say. Well, you don't like Luke Walton. Who are the other options here?
I told you.
Who?
Ettore Messina. I would have been fine with Blatt.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Okay, you were saying you want yeah, both of those guys.
Yeah. I would have been fine with either of those two guys. You can crap on Blatt if you want, but
so hold on. What's the difference? What is the difference between Walton and Blatt, though? They neither one of them really has that much NBA coaching experience. And I know you mentioned Blatt's overseas experience, but I don't think that really lines up with the NBA. It's not exactly the same thing. And I don't know. I understand why they would want to do the whole young coach, young team aspect. That makes sense to me. The Celtics kind of just did it themselves.
Yeah, but the difference between you can poo-poo his international experience if you want. He won several titles in in Israel with an offense, with a game plan that was you know, renowned for being creative and interesting. The same thing with the Spurs assistant coach. Luke Walton doesn't have that reputation, even though, yes, he was briefly the coach of the Warriors. I don't know that Luke Walton himself is an innovator of anything in particular. You know what I mean? Like, is there?
Yeah, you're probably right. That's what I was trying to say to start out. Like, is it really Luke Walton for the first 50 games of the season, or was it the assistants and Steve Kerr in his ear? And I would tend to believe it was the latter.
I don't know how creative he is. I don't know. Look, this might be I'm not, like, totally negative on this hire the way I was when the Lakers hired Byron Scott, because Luke Walton to me is he's just an unknown quantity. And I don't think, like, I don't like the hire because I don't think that you should take that much of a risk on the head coach of the Lakers when, you know, Luke Walton McKinn, like, I don't know what his plan is going to look like. I don't know if he's, like, considered an offensive or a defensive genius. I don't know if Phil Jackson then comes back, will Luke Walton then embrace some form of the triangle, the offense that he played under in his NBA career, an offense which is woefully outdated? I don't know whether or not that's going to happen, you know? Like, why? Yeah, I don't know. I don't like this move in any respect. It just makes me nervous. But who knows? It could turn out spectacularly. I guess I'm trying to cover my bases here in case Luke Walton turns out to be a great coach. But I do like the fact that he's young. I do like the fact that he gets along with young players because, you know, the Lakers are full of young players, so you probably don't want a crotchety old man coach like Byron Scott trying to deal with guys like D'Angelo. Yeah, even Tom Thibodeau. Well, Thibodeau's other problem was that he wanted to be GM, which was never going to happen with the Lakers.
Right, that's true. All right, so you've got your Laker talk out of the way then?
I did. I feel good, thank you.
All right. Now on, we're good to go? I don't need to care about the Lakers? All right, so we're good. Back on track. Luke Walton discussion out of the way. Where are we? Oh, yes. The games that are actually still happening, the teams that are actually playing right now, the Spurs and the Thunder, two Western Conference title contenders there, Calvin, in a dogfight. They split the first two games of their series, although Spurs fans are arguing that they should have had more of a chance to win that game than in game two last night than they actually did. Isn't that right?
It is right. We'll get to that in a second. Can I start off, Ray, by just marveling at the low post greatness that is LaMarcus Aldridge? It's so refreshing to have a guy with, like, with all the constant talk about how, you know, being a low post player, being a power player, like, makes you irrelevant in today's NBA. It's so refreshing. And I don't like the Spurs, and I want the Spurs to lose this series. Let's be clear on that. I am rooting so hard for the Thunder to win this series. But it's just so refreshing to see LaMarcus Aldridge, like, stand on the block, you know, with a guy behind him and no movement around. He's just posting up, 15 feet on the outside of the free throw line, just waiting for that ball. And the second he gets the ball on that block, he's going to score. He put up 38 points. He was, you know, 11 out of 13 or whatever he was in those two games. I know I'm just making these up off the top of my head, but he was so good. I think maybe 11 or 13 was the first half. He was so good, and I'm so glad to, like, just see a dominant post force in action who's not, you know, being told by stat nerds that he's now become an irrelevant player because the Spurs are, you know, one of the two best teams in basketball.
Well, I'm trying to find the numbers exactly, and I'm getting his six games here. This is not what I was looking for. Okay, here we go. 41 points on 15 of 21 in game 2, 38 points on 18 of 23 shooting in game 1.
And, listen to that. Listen to yourself.
Dude, that is double his his attempts and triple his makes from the last series that they swept Memphis in. It's almost as if he wasn't even trying or something, or the Spurs in general were just not, they were just going through the motions against Memphis, and now they've stepped it up quite a bit, because the touches for Aldridge in this series so far in the first two games have just been unreal.
Great. Aldridge is shooting 63% for the playoffs. Really?
Yeah, and it's like 75% in the first two games of the series right now. It's insane.
Yeah, by the way, he's being one-on-one guarded by Serge Ibaka. Let's not pretend that it's like Hannes Kanter that he's just scoring over all the time. He's getting Serge Ibaka on him for the most part. He's getting a little bit of Steven Adams, another excellent defender, and he's just destroying them because he knows old school how to make a shot with a guy in his face. And I just wanted to give credit to a beast among men. I think we forget, because his numbers were kind of down this year. You know what I mean? I think we also forget.
Well, yeah,
because
of the system.
The system, but also the rise of Kawhi. You know, this year was like the year that Kawhi was, you know, third or fourth in MVP voting, depending on how you want to look at it.
Sure.
Or even theoretically second, I guess. I think he lost in the praise of Kawhi and the lowering of his numbers. The simple fact that LaMarcus Aldridge is one of the very best players in basketball, one of the dozen or so best players. So I just wanted to give him his props in this moment, because.
And I mean, that must be painful for you, because the Spurs have him locked up for the next two full years and with a player option after that. So your arch rivals there, Calvin, are going to have one of the top players in the league for years to come. The guy that you apparently like quite a bit. Maybe you're going to have to be a Spurs fan.
And he spurned my team to get there.
Yeah, man.
Don't forget that.
Right. Hey, I'll never forget that. He's a good man in my eyes.
Yeah, well, enough about the stupid Spurs. They lost. They're losers.
They lost, they lost because of a bigger question and a bigger issue with the NBA that's been going on for years, and that is the referees, the officiating, Calvin, the officials. They blew a call. They admitted to not seeing some things in this game at the end, and Spurs fans are clamoring about it because they feel like their team was screwed out of an actual possession at the end of this game.
Oh really? Is that how they feel? Really? Because the NBA came out. Well, first of all, Spurs fans, shut up. That's my one. Shut up. Nobody wants to hear you crying. All right, about refereeing. I hate. This is like the Munger syndrome where everyone wants to just pay attention to what happened in one isolated portion of the game, because you know that isolated portion has the exact same impact that every other portion of the game had. You know what I mean? Like, how do I know Russell Westbrook wasn't fouled six times that were not called in comparison to this one supposed no call? I don't know if you watched this game. You said you've been busy lately. I should have pulled up the audio. But really, the main reason this is even an issue right now is Chris Webber. I don't know if you've ever heard him call a game or not.
Yeah, it was Webber, man. He was going crazy.
Yeah, that's an offensive foul. That's an offensive foul. Here's the thing, Ray. Okay? Yes, it was an offensive foul. However, the Spurs stole the ball on that possession immediately anyway. And so Webber tried to make the argument that, well, no, then they would have had time to set. They would have had time to set up and draw up a play. Yeah, you know what? You know who else would have had time to set up and draw up a play in that scenario? The Oklahoma City Thunder. Their defense would have had the time to get set. You know, people don't realize this, but the offense has the advantage in chaos. Patty Mills had an open three that he just airballed. So let's remember that, first of all, before we start crying about how it was a terrible call. Look, the game still continued. They still had an open look with a chance to win the game. And they have to go back, and because Weber screamed like a maniac, they have to go back to this call. And yes, it was a weird play, an extremely weird play. But you know what would have happened if they had called the foul? Yeah, the Spurs would have just gotten the ball anyway. When they had the ball, the defender would have had time to set up, and they would have had to take a more difficult shot. You had a look, and you had a rebound, by the way. And then he dropped the ball or whatever, and then it was a scramble, and they ran out of time. But that was it. So, by the way, Spurs fans, like, if LaMarcus Aldridge doesn't get fouled on his 3-point attempt 10 seconds earlier, you would have lost the game anyway. You were down by 4 with 13 seconds left. So you were lucky to even be in that situation. Now, you made your own luck there, that's fine. But, like, let's not pretend the Spurs were screwed. Oh, I feel so bad for the Spurs. Don't feel bad for the Spurs. Moreover,
wow.
Right?
Calvin, with multiple rants on the show tonight.
I think I'm going to leave that one right there.
I'm going to leave it right there. We're done with that segment.
The bigger
question has not been answered yet. We're just done with the rant portion of the segment. The bigger question is, should the referees and the NBA be coming out and be transparent, as they have been since Adam Silver took over from David Stern, about referee blown calls and things that they missed, things that were called the wrong way? I think it's great. I like it, Calvin. I think that I want to hear more of this, and I want to hear more Kenny Maurer saying that he screwed up. But of course, it leads to the inevitable conspiracy theory that they're just doing this so that they can continue to screw up and just sweep it under the rug. But overall, I like the at least apparent accountability that they're trying to portray here, and just the fact that they're trying to get the refs to start making better calls, and they're shedding light on the things that they've screwed up and they're admitting to it, I think is a step in the right direction. We'll have to wait and see where it goes from here, but I like it. How about you?
Why don't we just look into what the NBA said about the way this game ended? Apparently, according to the NBA, the referees incorrectly neglected to call a delay of game on Ginobili for crossing over the line, which I didn't even hear anyone mention. All I heard Chris Webber screaming about Deion Waiters pushing him or elbowing him, but like no mention of the fact that Ginobili's like putting his face over the line. So the NBA noticed that, right? Didn't call it a delay of game on him for that. Didn't call a foul on Waiters for shoving him. Didn't call a foul on Patty Mills for grabbing Steven Adams on that play. A foul on Kawhi Leonard, Murray, for grabbing Russell Westbrook on that play. Or a foul on Serge Ibaka for grabbing LaMarcus Aldridge. Does that clarify that situation for you at all? Do you feel like you now know you know who would have won the game had the referees not messed up? Does that make you feel better?
I don't. I thought the rant portion was over.
No, it's not over. It's not over at all. Here's why I don't like it. Okay, it makes somewhat more sense in football to me, but the nature of refereeing in the NBA in particular, or even in baseball, because baseball has these things called lines. You know, foul. Something's either a foul or it's not. Somebody's either safe or he's not. But a foul is such a subjective notion, and we've for years and everyone in the NBA plays under this same notion that the referees swallow their whistles at the end of games. It's just a biological fact of the NBA. They missed 4 fouls at the end of that game there. You know why? Because the NBA doesn't want to call a foul in that situation. Everybody knows it, and everybody plays to those rules. So if they come out after the fact and say, hey, we should have called these 4 fouls in this situation, you're just making the referees look bad when I'm sure a lot of those were conscious decisions to not let the game be decided by a whistle. We don't want, and do you as a fan, do you want every little ticky-tack thing at the end of every game to be called? Is that what you want basketball to become, Murray? Is that, because you're legislating toward that notion by saying, yes, the NBA should come out and note every time they think something should have been called.
Yeah, I mean, if it's egregious enough that they think they need to make a comment about it, then yeah. I mean, there have been times over the course of the season where they've confirmed that referees' calls are correct, or they've explained that the whole contact rule that they're talking about, as far as like going straight up and down, and how they try to enforce that, and de-emphasize the fact that, I mean, that shouldn't be a foul if you're straight up and down. Even if you are up in the air, you're allowed to jump now and still defend, you know? So I think they're doing it, and it works in both ways. And it's just a matter of getting the referees to clean up their act. And over time, they won't have to disclose all those things anymore, because the game will be a little bit cleaner as far as the officiating is concerned. I want them to get it right, Calvin. I mean, I just... If there's something that really affects the course of a game, and it's an egregious foul that the league feels should have been called on the floor, then I want them to get it right, and more power to them for putting it out there.
Really, they're never going to get it right. You're living in a pipe dream. They're not going to get it right. They're going to get something wrong.
Then, of course, they're going to get things wrong, and that's human error. I still want to work towards getting it right. So, I mean, sure, the NBA maybe doesn't need to nitpick and throw every little foul out there for as far as the grabs are concerned, but as far as Ginobili and the delay of game, and then Waiters with the offensive foul, those ones seemed obvious, and that's the type of stuff that I think should be called. The grab on Aldridge, or the Patty Mills grabbing on people, that happens in the course of a game. You see that all the time, and that's the type of stuff that, if I were the NBA, I'd draw the line there and leave that out of my little memo. But in general, I like the idea of the accountability and putting the refs in the spotlight.
Okay, so then going back to my earlier thing briefly about the Spurs. So let's just rewind time, right, and fix history. And the first thing that happened, right, was a delay of game on Ginobili for crossing the line, right? That's one free throw for the Thunder. They miss it. Then they get another inbounds. What happens from there? Nobody knows, right? Nobody knows. Yeah. So that was
Chris Webber's point as far as the foul was concerned. And that's what he saw in real time. He didn't think about the Ginobili thing. I'm sure that if he realized Ginobili had committed the delay of game at the time of his commentary, that he wouldn't have been going crazy for the offensive foul. It's just a matter of what he saw first. So I'm not going to get on Chris Webber for trying to make things seem like the offensive foul should have been called. If that's what he saw, then that's what he saw. In reality, it should have been a delay of game. And in real time, if he had known that, he's probably not going clamoring for the offensive foul.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm just saying this. Look, this goes to like all fans, and you can say maybe the league muddied it up intentionally and made it difficult to interpret. But what I'm saying is just looking at this play, all these things. Look, to me, it's like the opposite of like the justification for like, see, the NBA admitted they messed up here. It's like they mess up things. They mess up so many things that those things become redundant. It's like it's a paradox at some point. I don't need you do need to know about if you need to know about one of these things, really, if the NBA has to come out and say yes, that was an offensive foul, then yeah, I do want the 45. I don't even want the things that happened in the 13 seconds. Give me 200 missed calls throughout the game, because it just shows that like the result of the game, if you take away referee error out of it. Like, there's no way of knowing what that's going to be. And that's the point that I'm making to you. It's ultimately irrelevant, especially if you're just trying to isolate one thing, when even on that one play, the NBA found five things that could have been called in a different manner.
Well, that's fine. And I don't want to slow the game down, so...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that they should be still calling every little thing, but I think in crunch time... on plays that are obvious and plays that matter, plays that they can see quickly on a replay, or something that they should have caught in real time, maybe if they had an additional official or something, it should be called. So,
we're going to
disagree.
Game.
What's that?
No, nobody plays defense. Every game should look like an all-star game. Nobody plays defense because they're going to call us off.
No, I don't think that's... I think you're missing the point. Because you can play good defense without fouling. So, let's move on. Because we're almost done.
Okay.
What's going on here?
I really do want to continue this. I don't know why.
Well,
but, wait.
Yeah,
let's,
you know how much
say,
I hate arguing about officiating. It's just...
I know. But let's just say that the Celtics in 2009, like, after every game, the NBA came out and, like, they were like, Kevin Garnett got away with 9 moving screens. Would you be like, great job, NBA, for calling him out on those? Or would you be like, yeah, that's what Kevin Garnett does. He's smart. He gets away with moving screens. You'd probably say the latter, right?
I mean, I guess it depends on how many I would have noticed myself. And then going back, I mean, honestly, Calvin, obviously guys are going to get away with things. And this goes back to the Marcus Smart point from earlier, too. He tries to get away with a lot of things, or he thinks that he gets away with a lot of things, and the referees are starting to catch on to it, and the NBA is starting to catch on to it. In this modern era, with all these different cameras and all the different angles and eyes on everything, it seems inevitable to me that they're going to at least review this stuff with a fine-tooth comb, you know? And I think it's a good thing, because you just need to embrace it and not sort of be stuck in the past. So Marcus Smart's going to get called out for flopping. He should stop flopping. If the NBA is going to call out their referees for missing calls that they think should have been called, then the referees should start making those calls. That's it.
Okay. I'll let it go at this point. I'll leave it at that.
All right. I'm running out of steam anyway. So, what's going on with Chris Bosh? He's talking about wanting to play in this series, and I mean, of course, if you are unaware of why he's not playing, he had a blood clot again. He's had multiple blood clots over the past couple of years, and he's been sidelined for it before. And now he says he wants to play again. Is that right?
Yes. So the thing about Chris Bosh's blood clots is they were originally found in his calf. Okay? This season they were found in his leg. I'm sorry, in his lung. Calf, leg, lung. Yeah. So that can cause an embolism. Obviously, you can't play basketball with a blood clot in your lung. He's been on blood thinners, and that sort of removed the clot. So he's currently clot-free. But because he's already had a recurrence of the blood clot issue, if he has a blood clot, you know, while he's playing on the court, obviously he's not going to know at, you know, any given time. It can be seriously, seriously dangerous for him. He's on the blood thinner again, like I said, which also makes his blood thin. So if he gets cut during a game, he could, you know, bleed out. It basically gives him hemophilia. There's a lot of reasons why it's essentially dangerous for Chris Bosh to play basketball. But Chris Bosh himself feels great. He feels fine. He's totally healthy. He's ready to go. I can see why he feels frustration. He sees his teammates out there on the court. I mean, at this point, he's probably the Heat's best player, right? Or, you know, first or second best player, you can make an argument that with Chris Bosh, the Heat, you know, would make for an interesting matchup against Cavaliers.
Definitely.
But I find it interesting because it's like, it's a role reversal of the usual situation where, like, the team is like, fudging medical reports and, like, giving a guy a shot at a knee to get him back into a game. The Heat seem to be saying, no, we're not going to let you play, even though it would technically help them to have Chris Bosh play. And Chris Bosh is dying to play, even though, like, it might not be responsible. I guess I'm curious, what do you do in this situation? If he says he feels fine and he wants to play, do you think that he should be responsible for himself if he is healthy? Or do you think the team is being responsible by saying, no, you can't play? And if they say that, does that mean, like, Chris Bosh's career just has to be over? Because, you know, the chance that the blood clot comes back will always exist, right?
Yeah, this is a tough choice because ultimately, I think the players are responsible for themselves. And I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago, where players get hurt and they sort of decide themselves to come back on the court. And if the trainers say they're okay, then it's up to them. And if they, the whole thing with Steph Curry, if he felt like he was ready to come back, then maybe it's on him, because the trainers can't really tell what his body feels like. And while his knee injury was a slip and fall and not necessarily something that stems from the ankle injury, I always tend to think that when somebody gets hurt in one part of their body, then they're more prone to an injury in another if they don't let it heal enough before going back out there. So in regards to that, maybe Curry came back a little too soon. But ultimately, I think guys should be responsible for themselves. And if they think that they're good enough to get back out on the court and a doctor clears them, then it's not necessarily, I don't think the team should be able to hold them out. Unless the team has a second opinion from a doctor that says that he shouldn't be playing, then I don't think they can hold him off the court. But you know what? Ultimately, I don't know where that comes down to, because Danny Ainge always says that Brad Stevens is the one that decides who goes on the court, you know? And if Brad Stevens always says, well, if the players are healthy, I'm going to play them. So does that come down to Eric Spoelstra about whether he wants to play Chris Bosh or not? Who takes the fall for that if Chris Bosh has to retire because of this? I don't know. It's a touchy subject.
It is. And it'll be really interesting to see what they do here. I guess, as you know, it maybe just comes down to selfishness for me, but as like a fan of basketball, I want to see Chris Bosh come back and at least give it a shot. And I feel like physically, especially if like physically he's okay, I don't know. I guess it is a risk, but for me, ultimately, I come down to like if this is what he decides he wants to do with his life, like, And he's certainly, you know, productive enough for the team to be able to use him. Like, I guess, like, I'm sort of on the side of...
So, how do you go about this if you're the team, then? Is there a way that you can get him tested at halftime? Or to see if he has blood clots, you know what I'm saying? Like, would it creep up that quickly? I don't know how this works. Like, does the test take a while? Do the results take a while to come back? Would they be able to monitor that stuff in-game where he can play with no repercussions? I would imagine the technology is not there right now, or they would be doing it, but maybe going forward, that's something they have to look into.
Yeah, I would imagine that no. I would imagine that he would need testing done for that to be discovered. So I don't think it's something you can just have a trainer look at.
Yeah, probably
not.
Yeah.
So I think that he would, in almost any circumstance, if another blood clot appeared, that he would play with it for some period of time before they sat him down. I mean, the last two blood clots he had, he played with for a while before they discovered them, and so I guess that's where they're at. But he says that. Yeah, he says that he's not feeling life-threatened or in any physical danger. And I guess, you know, again, cruelty aside, you don't want to see anything bad happen to Chris Bosh on the court. But if he wants to play and is willing to, you know, maybe, I'm sure there's something that could be worked out with insurance and with sort of absolving the Heat from responsibility in that respect. I think from the Heat's perspective, they'd love to have him back. I don't necessarily think it's complete altruism. I think, like, if something bad did happen to Chris Bosh, you know, the team, it would be a PR, you know, catastrophe.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's tough to hold a man off. I mean, I guess they're paying him, so it's not like they're taking away his money or anything like that. But if this is what he wants to do, I mean, I don't know. Like you said earlier, they're basically forcing him to retire at this point if they don't want him to play because of this.
I guess that's sort of my question too. Is are they, like, I mean, I would, if I were to ask you right now, like, do you think Chris Bosh will be playing with the Miami Heat next season? What would your answer be? I kind of, my feeling, my sense would be yes. But then I think, like, okay, well, what difference does, like, another offseason make in this particular scenario? If he's fine
well,
now.
Well, I mean, in the last time they let him play, they let him come back, and then they had to, they went for more testing, et cetera, and they found it again, and then they shut him down. So, I mean, what is the difference between this time and last time besides that it happened again? If they trusted that it wouldn't happen again last time, I don't know. I don't know how recurring, how badly this type of thing recurs once it happens once. Is it constantly happening over time? It'll definitely happen again, or is it the type of situation that may happen once or twice in a lifetime and that's it? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the medical part of it either to know, but I think that it's certainly possible that it can come back again, especially because they've occurred once. And I think with that, you just have to sort of weigh the odds that it's going to come back against how much you really want to go forward with it. I think Bosh has clearly made up his mind. From the team's perspective, it's a much more difficult decision.
Well, we'll see how the Heat fare in this playoff series against Cleveland. And, no, they're not playing Cleveland. Against Indiana, right?
They are playing Toronto.
Toronto, Jesus. Losing my mind,
yep.
Man. We should have ended this show 5 minutes ago. Indiana, of course. Indiana. Dummy. Toronto, of course. Miami, Toronto, Cleveland, and the Hawks. Those jerks. One more topic, or do you want to get out of here? The NFL draft, that's a thing that happened, right? There's a big debate around here about whether the Patriots had a good draft or not. Frankly, I don't care. Because the only thing that ever comes out of the NFL draft for me, Calvin, is stories of kids that are doing things that they shouldn't be doing and making fools out of themselves and just some of the wild situations that you hear about with some of these college kids. And the latest one is quite a crazy story. So why don't you take it away?
Yeah, I don't know anything about the NBA draft. I'm sorry, the NFL draft either, because I don't really care about college sports. And as a result, I'm not familiar with a lot of the players. But I was interested in new Miami Dolphins offensive tackle Laremy Tunsil, who was projected to go third right after the two quarterbacks. Is considered, the best player on the board, especially by Mel Kiper and a lot of other people. And 10 minutes before the draft, Rory, somebody uploaded a picture to Instagram that is supposedly him, but you can't tell for sure because it's somebody in a gas mask. And the gas mask is attached to a bomb. And this person is hitting the bomb, hitting the gas mask bomb. And just that alone officially was enough to drop this guy from, the potential third pick in the draft to the 13th pick in the draft. Look, I don't worry. I know
foolish.
The rest of America. Yeah, I know.
Foolish.
The rest of America.
You know what goes with that? You know what goes with those 10 spots, Calvin?
What's that?
$10 million. The kid lost out on $10 million because of this stuff.
Now, he claimed he was hacked. He said that he was being blackmailed. And this is like the rare case where I believe the guy who said he was being hacked. Because there's nobody stupid enough to post a picture of themselves smoking out of a bong 10 minutes before the NFL draft. We can at least agree on that much, right? Like, somebody.
I mean, I would hope so. I would hope he didn't do that himself. It would be pretty foolish.
Yeah. Somebody put that up to try to mess him up, and it worked. And I just think, look, man,
Are we still really here with weed? Like, the NFL's weed policy is ridiculous, like what they did to Josh Gordon, whatever, but like are we really here that 10 teams are so afraid of taking this guy just because of one photo that comes out minutes before the draft? And I know, like, apparently he took money from an agent too, but nobody cares about that. Let's say it's the Bong thing. It's the Bong thing. It's the fact that teams didn't know about it. Like, are we not on the verge of like marijuana being completely legal in this country? Like,
in a lot of places, yeah. It's a good point. And the NFL, it sort of they stick to their guns, their old ways, the old boy attitude. You know what I'm saying? And it's just, I don't know. I feel like a lot of guys suffer because of it, and it's really too bad. Because I mean, that's $10 million. And the rumor out there was that this guy was his stepfather or something that leaked it, and he's the one that wanted the money, and that doesn't make any sense either, because if his stepfather's suing him for whatever reason, wouldn't he just want to have the most money that he could, you know? So why would he blow up his draft stock? Something else is going on here, something more sinister, if you ask me. So that's really too bad.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that it messed up his draft stock. I'm pretty mad that the Giants didn't draft him because he was on the board there at 10. They're down for an offensive tackle, and this guy's going to be a dominant player. And nobody's going to care about this weed thing. People are not even going to remember it, you know, 6 months from now when this guy's blowing up holes in the NFL.
True, probably not.
Yeah. All right, I can leave it at that. I know you. I can tell your momentum is completely gone, right? You're just dying to get to bed or to do whatever it is you're going to do next. So, that's our show.
That is our show, and you know what? My momentum dies when I start talking about the NFL, especially, I don't know, something hit me like 20 minutes ago. I just started to lose it,
yep.
Calvin. But, excuse me, so I apologize for that. But I hope you enjoyed your time with me tonight, sir, because I always enjoy the hour with you.
I definitely enjoyed it.
Wonderful. We heard from Mad Dog tonight. That was nice, too. Thank you for listening, everybody out there. We'll try to get a show in on Tuesday, but no guarantees. And then after that,
yeah,
it's all up in the air. We're gonna play it by ear for a couple of weeks here. So stay tuned,
yeah.
And thank you all for listening. What do you think? What do you say?
Yeah. Good night, everybody.
Oh, good night, everybody. That's all he says. Oh, I see.
Whoop!
What?
No. I was just gonna say, yeah. We've been off schedule a lot because of NBA playoffs, the Celtics playoff games. But we're gonna try to get, once we're really settled in, we're gonna try to get back to a more regular schedule. That's all.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're damn right about that. All right. Now, the piano. Here we go.